This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
Whole part of the show, man.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to Pollock and Thurston for another week. It is the post Wrestle Kingdom edition of the show. We were going to do a match by match rundown, but I told Brandon, I don't know if we'll have time for a full review of the show, but we will talk about some of the high points.
We had to cut that.
We had to cut that down. So no match review. Wanted some of Brandon's thoughts on the Rambo, but that will have to be, saved for another day. But we will be joined a little later on by Karen Peterson of Post Wrestling. She is going to be chatting with us a bit about, Wrestle Kingdom and the past couple of days for New Japan. And the year ahead, we have a lot of legal updates. We have several lawsuits to discuss. We have several hearings to mention. And of course, we got charts. We've got holiday tour charts, courtesy of the WrestleNomics team.
I even submitted a filing this week, but which we will not talk about. Maybe later. Maybe next week.
Yeah, some things are confidential for the time being.
It's a filing under seal, so we'll leave it at that.
Yes. Netflix, further entrenching themselves with WWE. You now, folks, you gotta be, you gotta do like mix and match. You want to watch all your historical WWE content? Well, there's a cutoff date now of September 2025 that you're going to have multiple streaming services to go back to the WWE library. You want to watch the Survivor Series from last November? You go to ESPN. You want to watch Survivor Series from 5 years ago? You got to go to Netflix now in the U.S. So,
I like it's more options, more platforms for me to engage with and to, distribute my watch time upon. You know, it's no longer the old days of the WWE Network brought to you by MLB AM. I get to be on the ESPN platform. Maybe I get it for free if I'm on the right distributor and on the right tier within that distributor. And then I can also consume more content on Netflix, as well as Tubi if I want to watch Evolve. I can also check out, the Vault, the WWE Vault, a great YouTube channel, on YouTube. And I also have to be a cable subscriber to get, SmackDown on USA Network. And I might need cable or an antenna to get NXT.
I look forward to the Motor City Machine Guns doing a vignette on SmackDown explaining that and all the different places you have to go with. All I want to know is, if I am an American, where's my goddamn Smoky Mountain Wrestling? Where is it? Where's Smoky my Mountain Smoky Vault? Mountain Wrestling YouTube channel?
Is there a Smoky Mountain Vault YouTube channel?
I don't think that's I haven't seen it pop up on Netflix yet. No non-WWE content to me has shown up on Netflix yet. But I'm sure we are going to get the whole history of New Jack and all the deep-rooted rivalries that were presented by Jim Cornette with the financial assistance of Rick Rubin.
Well, as I always tell people, you just wait until, you know, we've only got, well, you know, when did that stuff happen in the 90s? That's content that's 30 years old. So I think everything enters the public domain at 100 years. So there's only like 70 more years to go, and you won't have to, you know, listen to the stock music that they've inserted over, natural born killers. You know, just wait 70 more years and all that will be public and free for everybody, just as Mickey Mouse is now or something, some old Mickey Mouse cartoons, right?
It's exactly how Smoky Mountain. That was the long-term game they were playing. Just wait it out for the first 100, and then it'll be the world's gift will be coming to you. It looks like Paramount is not going to be gifted anything from the Warner Brothers shareholders. It looks like, you know, when you're trying to ask out the girl to the prom and she says no, and then you give her gifts. You really, like, at a certain point, you got to, like, contact the authorities that this is getting a little obsessive, a little stalkerish. Paramount, I believe this is like the 8th time that they have been turned down at this point. And
this is just the second offer, right? This is the amendment to their original offer.
I think it's whatever you want to look at as other, like before the official bid was made, what potential offers were made in all of this. It's the second, I would say, significant rejection. At any point, WBD is advising its shareholders as of Wednesday to reject the latest bid by Paramount, citing their bid being more risky. And even though Larry Ellison is personally guaranteeing $40 billion in equity in his latest bid, WBD is stating, you know what, we are Netflix or die. That is what I'm hearing. And that is certainly, I am sure, going to let Paramount sit down and say, you know what, it's just not ours to have. This is not going to work. I'm sure they're going to just go off into the corner and move on. Life after WBD, right? This is the end of the story.
Yeah, they're saying that the transaction that Paramount is proposing would be the biggest leverage buyout in history. Maybe adjusting for inflation or not, I don't know. And that they would need how many billions of dollars? $87 billion of total pro forma gross debt. We'll need Mark Shapiro to explain to us exactly what that means. But I was thinking, does Larry Ellison even have, what is it again? It's on the screen. $87 billion in his net worth. According to Google, if you just Google Larry Ellison net worth, he's got about $240 billion in net worth. You might have to move some things around to get that kind of liquidity though.
Yeah. From afar, I enjoy someone that's got like that level of worth attached to them. And there's something they can't get. I think that is, you know, something aspirational for the common man out there, that yes, even Larry Ellison can't get everything he wants. So
yes. There's
that aspect to this entire game that will continue, but it does feel.
So I do have a question, though, about this.
Okay. Well, they're going out of business. I mean, this is clearly
the audio listeners. What does this mean for AW?
Yeah, I think that this is D-Day. This latest bid refusal,
because it doesn't matter. There's W partners over here in Netflix. There's TKO partners, UFC partners over there in Paramount.
Yeah, I mean, is it a coincidence that Netflix just struck this library deal with WWE and they're about to acquire WBD? I think that Netflix is clearly, they are a northern based operation when it comes to professional wrestling. Okay, they are loyal to Stamford, Connecticut, and Jacksonville, they're in a lot of trouble, and not just against the Buffalo Bills this weekend.
Yes, oh, that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bills versus Jaguars.
You versus Tony Khan this weekend.
We'll see what happens. We'll see if this is in Jacksonville, right? So will there be on the broadcast, will we see the Khan family up in the suite during the game?
Yeah. I would think so. I would imagine the whole...
Do they ever show them? Like, I don't watch Jaguars games ever, so I don't know.
Yeah, I would think the whole Beatnik group would be present for such a significant game.
Beatnik Investments LLC. You know who does get shown a lot, who I do see sometimes, is during Patriot games, because the Bills do have to play the Patriots twice a year. You do see... What is his name? The son, the son of the owner, who owns the Patriots. Everyone's screaming at me now.
Robert Kraft,
Jonathan Kraft, his son. You do see him up there, a TKO board member.
That's correct. Yes. It all is tied together through the extended web of a TKO board members and where their tentacles extend to. So Wrestle Kingdom,
the super chats are just flowing in. Should we?
Oh, maybe, let's go into the super chats.
We're addressing AEW anxiety. We can address this question here. Do you want to read it?
AEW ratings and attendance down, but pay-per-views do same number every month within 20,000 range. High 145,000, low 125. Isn't this mathematically impossible? No.
For two independent values to be unaffected by each other, it's I can see why there would be skepticism, but yes, it's mathematically possible.
It's like I don't work out, but I'm a great hockey player in my rec league on Sundays. Mm-hmm. It's like it doesn't necessarily make sense, but it can be done. AEW, I think, let's take television ratings aside, because I think there's so many ways that you can look at these numbers and what has affected it.
Where are these numbers coming from?
The television numbers.
Well, the pay-per-view numbers are coming from the Observer.
The pay-per-view numbers are largely coming from the Observer. So that is what we are going upon. But television numbers, like if you want to tell a story about, you know, their television is, it's not compelling people. They're not growing. You can tell that story. You can also look at all of the outside effects of numbers and its streaming. Attendance is one that I think we can take at least a cleaner picture of. And I think that is very clear that this year, if it's not flat, it is, you know, their numbers for weekly television, it is, you know, nothing spectacular generally for most of these shows, unless it's a really special show. But the pay-per-views are clearly like the A content that this company produces, whether you want to look at attendance, whether you want to go by what the Observer is reporting with the number of buys that it is holding up to. I think you can look at, there has at least been a shift that you can make the argument that if in a previous era when there were less pay-per-views, people were at least watching Dynamite week to week. I think now you probably have a decent percentage of fans that are maybe not watching all the television, but they're still watching the pay-per-views every month. And that might be the extent of their AEW consumption, but the pay-per-views are still seen as the must-see shows for AEW. And the television is going to be more dependent on, you know, what is like going to buy a ticket to a show or even tuning in to watch a show. Like, do you see that as reasonable theory, or do you think I'm out to lunch here?
I mean, I wish we had some better transparency and insight into what the pay-per-view numbers are. We have Dave's numbers that he gets and estimates and determines however he does. You can tell yourself an economic story about how that's possible. It's your most hardcore product that people are paying up an upcharge of $50 for, or whatever it is in their territory. And that's your most hardcore fans that are going to drop $50 for your product like that. So maybe they're the ones who are hardest to turn away. They have the highest demand, so they're the ones who are sticking with it the longest.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, you can certainly look at the addition of more pay-per-views and what impact that has had. I think it is to me, live attendance is still what it is. The idea of AEW mm-hmm. is coming to town, I think we're long past that. Just AEW coming to town is going to necessarily engage people to just want to go. It's going to be, you know, what the show contains. And I think it is less of an appealing live event experience than it was in years past, for whatever reasons. And people have gone over all their theories about what is promoted in advance. Do you know what stars you're going to be seeing? Or just boiling it down to, is it a hot product? I'm not going to argue that AEW, it is not a hot product at the moment. I don't think it's as cold as it was maybe a year ago. It's somewhere in between, but it's like, that's sort of where I see AEW as, if we're looking for these popularity metrics and where it stands.
Yeah, I think attendance tells you the clear story, and attendance continues to be down year for year.
All right. We'll probably circle around to more AEW unless there's anything else here. These super chats, I don't quite understand the questions that are being asked here, but we can still. Restoring the V4 title, predict a bumper New Japan year.
I think it's a comment more than a question, yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, more New Japan to come, I promise. Speaking of Wrestle Kingdom 20, we do have the announced attendance that the company gave of 46,913, and Hiroshi Tanahashi held a press conference on Tuesday. He stated that over 3.5 million watched the special nationwide, and that approximately 155,000 people watched the show live. Now, what does that mean? The TV Asahi broadcast was on tape delay, so that was not a live broadcast, and it was airing on TV Asahi in a, like, from 10:15 till 11:55 p.m. on Sunday evening. Now, my understanding is that there was also a separate broadcast that was like this 4-hour broadcast. I'm understanding this to be that this is this hour and 40 minute window had 3.5 million viewers. I'm going by Hiroshi Tanahashi here. But the 155.
Did he reveal to us the New Japan World subscriber number? Is that what he's saying that is? That just assuming like every subscriber or the subscribers that were watching?
155,000 would include the live attendance. And then if you make up the difference there, that would give you roughly 109,000 subscribers to New Japan World that I cannot imagine. I could buy that 109,000 are the number of subscribers. Yeah. I could not believe that every subscriber was watching live.
Probably not.
Because we have not gotten a New Japan World number in years.
Yeah, and I think it maybe topped out at around 100,000.
So that was Hiroshi Tanahashi. But overall, this was a ultra successful event for New Japan. It sold out the initial configuration for the Tokyo Dome, which what a history of Tokyo Dome attendances that we have. I don't wish anyone to have to go back and decipher the attendances that we had a whole generation that grew up with the ability to believe that 60,000 people could fit in this Tokyo Dome.
Inoki put, I think, 70 in there, supposedly.
You know what? When it comes to Inoki, you can create wings of a stadium in your mind's eye and fill them as well. But generally, this would be believed to be the biggest one-night New Japan card going back to Inoki's retirement in April of 1998. And when the Wrestle Kingdom branding was introduced in 2007, this would certainly be the most successful. Now, it's worth noting, 2020, they had two nights that did 40 and 30, roughly, on two successive nights. But, this had the expanded configuration, and I cannot fathom that there is going to be any time soon that this number is going to be threatened at the Tokyo Dome.
So what I've got on the screen here for people watching in video is every Wrestle Kingdom going back to 2015, which is when we believe New Japan started to report more honest numbers. I don't know what exactly this is in terms of, is it tickets distributed? It's probably not tickets sold. Anyway, we believe around May 2015, I think they start to be more honest with their attendances that they put on the website. And this is, easily the biggest attendance for a single night. But if you stack that 2020 year, of course, that goes to over 70,000.
So no gate figure that is known for this yet, but this would, this certainly represented, a big window of opportunity for New Japan, not just like with Tanahashi's retirement, but the anticipation of Aaron Wolf's debut that largely, I think, opened up TV Asahi to be interested. This is the first time that they have broadcast a Dome show since 2004. So we're going back over 20 years since they have had that level of interest, at least from their home network as well. Did you catch any of Wrestle Kingdom?
I did not.
No. There was a retirement.
I heard.
There was no Shinsuke Nakamura, but he was represented in armband form.
Right. No, wrestling politics.
They get in the way. All right. We'll talk more about this with Karen. Let's talk a little bit about, the WWE holiday tour that just went down. This ran from December 26th until January 4th. And you and Jason did a breakdown of the attendance figures for all of the shows. And What did you find? Because this is basically the only domestic house show tour of the year now for WWE, other than like the odd live event that might pop up. But generally, their house shows are international and the holiday tour.
Right. I think as far as domestic tours, and I think we wrote it in here, as far as domestic house shows, this accounted for most, and I know this flowed into the current year. But just taking the 2025 ones towards the end of December, this was most of the domestic, that is U.S. or Canada, house shows for the year for WWE. And it was down. I mean, it's the second consecutive year that it is down. It was down a little more strongly than it was the prior year. 6,700 is the average tickets distributed for this house show tour, down from 8,900, peaking at in 2023. 9,700. However, we did have Fightful Select you know, putting out before we reported this, that there were record gates, house show record gates anyway, for Baltimore and Worcester. Worcester is how you pronounce that, that city in Massachusetts. Presumably higher ticket prices than ever. I think as someone said, in a comment responding to this article, the Mark Shapiro special.
Mark Shapiro would be happy if it was like the Apex and you had 10 people there that were billionaires, buying tickets. Yeah. It's like
paying $1 million each. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it, obviously, like that is an aspect that we have to look at with these ticket numbers. And even if they are down, like, what is the value of these lower numbers? But I think it can still tell you, like, it illustrates a story, though, that even like we know about what they are aggressively, you know, pricing these tickets at. But what is the effect that is having overall? It's that you are appealing to less people at these prices. And even if it is more profitable to run at these, you know, at these ticket prices, like, it is still leaving people that are reaching a breaking point that would be going to these shows otherwise that are not coming back. And is this indicative of popularity? I don't necessarily say that, because I think there's probably a good amount of people that are not going to these shows, not because of a lack of interest, but because of a lack of funds to be able to afford to go to a WWE show that they were spending a percentage less of in prior years in these same markets.
Yeah. I mean, this is, of course, sort of like the AEW question. If we want to look at popularity, whatever that means, I think we all have a general sense of what that means. And in AEW's case, that is, the live events are the cleanest, the cleaner story, because their ticket prices haven't changed dramatically, right? But in WWE's case, they have. So that does distort the cleaner story that we would have from attendance. And attendance is slightly down, especially on the SmackDown side. But if we look at, I don't know, SmackDown TV ratings, and we do have like a full quarter that just ended in Q4, if I bring it out over here, and they did about 1.1 million viewers for SmackDown. Now, I know there's cord cutting, but if we compare that to the Q4 of the prior year, they did 1.4 million, which is probably down worse than 10%, given if you want to adjust for cord cutting in there. So maybe there is a slight decrease in interest that we're seeing for WWE, or a plateauing at least.
Do you like this model overall? Like, does this tell you that this idea of scarcity of live events that you run pretty much this one week out of the year is best served now that we've seen it in practice for at least during the TKO period, that now we're down to like the lowest that WWE has ever been providing these live events? Or do you think like there is opportunity that's a better kind of, you know, not a full schedule, but something more than this?
It's still doing better than 2021. Now, I don't, maybe you could say that there was in 2021, this is right after you have returned to touring from the pandemic, but still up from the 5,100 they were doing in the very last, I guess you could say the last Vince head of creative year there. So there's at least that. That aligns with my sense is that WWE is still more popular than the very end of the Vince head of creative era. But I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion about, like, are they creating a risk? I mean, there is a risk, no doubt, but is it something that's going to really damage them in terms of, when, you know, if they do end up in a state of lower popularity, are the fans who can't afford to go now going to feel burned and then be less willing to go when they have to lower ticket prices, assuming that becomes a reality? I don't know. I guess I think that people's memories tend to be short, and this is creating a bad press story for them as far as goodwill with fans, which is, how much do you weigh that? Not a lot, probably. I don't think they weigh it a lot. Clearly, they just want to do what's going to create the biggest gates for them and create the biggest margin expansion.
Yeah, it's interesting to contrast, because I think that UFC, over time, they have really adopted this label of just the go-to is, well, these fighters are underpaid. And that's not a narrative you see assigned to WWE talent, but it's emerging this overall. It's just their overpricing of, overpricing is the wrong term, because a lot of people are paying for these tickets, but it is one that, I mean, you can just look at, you know, the comments under any WWE video or something. It's like the ticket prices. They're like the number one thing that get brought up by people more and more. And it's becoming it's a feature, not a bug for this company, but it is one that is certainly been attached to this TKO era that they are, you know, pricing these out. And the counter argument is that if they were selling out these shows immediately, like how much is that going onto the secondary market that were charging that much more and pocketing that? It's there. The company is in the mindset of that's our revenue that is being made elsewhere outside of the company. So we are going to take that back in and price these at the amount that enough people will buy them that is going to reach our level of revenue for these shows.
One thing that's also on the increase in terms of spending is we've got an inordinate number of super chats that are coming in. I'm sure we'll get to them. I do want to mention too just how much house shows are gone. I mean, it'll be no surprise to anybody, but just to quantify it, for the year of 2025 is now complete, and I could find in cage match 25 WWE main roster house shows. Of course, this doesn't include things they're doing with NXT, but 25. Main roster house shows. That includes the international. So in terms of US Canada, they did 9. I mean, in the year of 2020, where most of the year was wiped out because of COVID, they did 19 house shows in the US, Canada.
That's basically like 9 weeks of house shows that they condensed into 2020 before the pandemic. And they pretty much were almost equal to what they did all year internationally as well.
What we've got on the screen here for people watching the video is the count of main roster house shows going back to 2010. And again, for 2025, it's 25 house shows. This timeline peaks with 255 house shows, not including Raw, SmackDown, pay-per-views, just house shows, 255 in 2017.
Yeah. Like you're going back, like the early 2010s, like it was not uncommon that you were seeing guys generally doing 200 plus matches a year at the high end. And today, I mean, it's so different right at this point. And it's very hard to justify, should these wrestlers be doing 200 matches a year? Like there was certainly a level that this was not a live event business anymore, but that was sort of ingrained as like, this is what we do. We tour every weekend and we go across the country and we hit all these markets multiple times per year. And I think like you're seeing the extreme adjustment at this point, but you know, outside of the odd comment, like you heard from a Cody Rhodes recently with John Cena, like you don't see too many talent that are upset about this. Like they're making the exact same amount of money, if not more. They're home a lot more. They have, you know, probably a much better work-life balance than ever before. To be a WWE performer, it's not like you have to give up your family life or not have days off. So I think, you know, it was a big change, but I don't think the talent is complaining. And, you know, there is obviously, you know, there's markets you're not going to hit and there's people that are not going to be attending WWE shows. They will only experience it through watching on television, but that's the change. And this is like much more of like a media rights based company than it is going city to city.
Yeah. I think it probably avoids more injuries than it creates. I know there's a theory, there's like an Arn Anderson theory that wrestling less creates fewer calluses or, I mean, I get the idea that when you don't bump for a long time and then you do bump, you're going to be more sore than otherwise. But it just, I mean, there is another risk to in fewer reps. And does that hurt and impede the development of wrestlers? But it's probably resulting in fewer injuries than it would otherwise. I do see one long-term issue in that wrestlers of today, I don't know what they're going to have to romanticize, 10, 20 years from now when they're unable to talk about how they're on the road for, 300 days a week.
You know, they'll reminisce about, you know, their views on TikTok, you know, when they broke the internet.
That's true.
Yeah, those will be the shoot interviews of 2050 and beyond.
When Twitter was still called Twitter.
Yeah, back in the day. Netflix has landed the U.S. rights to the WWE library. This being the move from Peacock over to Netflix. People had started to see events populating beginning last Thursday. So again, this is a U.S. deal that will see WWE's library pre-September 2025. So they will have access. In theory, you would assume this gives them the rights to all WWE's library, although all that they are uploading right now are past WWE events. Like, we're not seeing WCW or ECW, and that's, I think it's just going to mirror what a lot of international fans have already had for the last year, which is all the past pay-per-views, and then the TV is kind of scattered throughout the years. It's like you have the whole Raw library for the last like 3 years, but then beyond that, it's sort of scattered year by year of what episodes are in there. And I imagine we're just going to see the continued, like, non-WWE libraries will be sectioned off for YouTube, or with due respect to Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Maybe
there's no SmackDown here, by the way. This was something that stood out to me.
SmackDown, I guess, still has the deal with USA. So I think SmackDown archives are still on Peacock, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't have access to Peacock, so I can't verify.
I could look, I suppose. I guess... I know they would have access, or would have, you know, even when there was the W Network, right? Like, it would take a 30-day delay for the newest episodes to show up. But I suppose that makes sense that those might be staying on Peacock.
And it's a multi-year deal. No financials revealed in this. What was the deal that they had with Peacock? That it was a 5-year deal in 2021, and trying to remember the value of that deal, but that also came with
$200 million a year for PLEs and library.
Yeah, but that all, yeah, of course, included all the PLEs as well. This is just a library deal. So there you have it, folks. So Netflix, ESPN, USA Network, CW. You just have to have all this stuff. You got to be equipped. You got to have, you know, Tubi, whatever is necessary to be a WWE consumer.
Hello, hello, hello. Davey Portman here from Poison Rana. We cover NXT every Tuesday night on the Post Wrestling feed in a show we call Up Next. But we do so much more. Follow Poison Rana Pod on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts for our live Sunday show, plus our Patreon with movie reviews, retro wrestling reviews, and more. Find out everything at poisonrana.ca.
New Japan. One-stop shop. You can sign up for New Japan World, and you'll get pretty much everything, unless they want to gouge you for a specialty show every now and then. But Wrestle Kingdom coming with your subscription, and that was everyone's focus this past Sunday. And we welcome in Karen Peterson from Post Wrestling herself, who is joining us to chat about this these past couple of days. Karen, how are you?
I'm very well. How's everyone doing?
Well, we are doing well, as well as New Japan appears to have done this past Sunday with quite a big show. It was a very important show for New Japan, not just, you know, focusing on Tanahashi's farewell, but really laying the groundwork for what the post Tanahashi era is going to look like for this company. In terms of meeting both of those objectives, how do you feel several days removed New Japan achieved on those fronts of, you know, the Tanahashi send-off, but also setting up their 2026 and beyond?
I'm cautiously optimistic at this point. I was a little 50-50 the day of Wrestle Kingdom. However, after New Year's Dash and, you know, everything that went down on there, it kind of gave me a more complete picture of what we can expect to look for. With the promotion for Wrestle Kingdom itself in Japan, it was being promoted not only as Tanahashi's retirement match, but they full leaned into that Aaron Wolf golden medalist Olympic hero narrative that they've like really wanted to draw in a lot of casual or, you know, non-viewers. Because when the Olympics come around, or when the World Cup or any other big sporting event comes around, the Japanese people just love sports so much. They were like, oh, we've got a gold medalist. Oh, he's going to continue doing something related to the sport he was in. I believe that pulled in a lot of the viewership, especially with as much promotion as they had done since they had signed him over the summertime.
And so what this led to with the arrival of Aaron Wolf was they got a slot on TV Asahi, which is their home broadcaster. And so they had a Sunday night slot for an hour and 40 minutes. And now my understanding is there was also another like 4-hour window. How was this
Correct.
Covered in Japan to the best of your knowledge? I know you're not in Japan.
Well, I pulled up. They still do TV guides on the Japanese broadcast websites, which makes everything so wonderful. And you can actually go back in time to see previous schedules. So the 1 hour 40 minute program was broadcast in the evening from 10:15 p.m. till 11:55, I believe. Mm-hmm. That was a condensed hour and 40 minute program highlighting mainly the top three matches on the card and the retirement ceremony.
Right.
However, they have a secondary channel that's like a digital broadcast channel, kind of like YouTube, but you know how most news channels or TV channels now have like their own subscription service. And from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m., they broadcast the entire main card on a separate channel that right. was available domestically. So the numbers that were listed, that 3.5 million, I'm curious to know, because it was kind of vague as to if it was specifically just for that one special or if that included the numbers from that separate channel for the entire broadcast of the show. Because this time of year in Japan, usually between around Christmas up until the 4th or, you know, whenever the end of the New Year's holiday weekend is, there's nothing but special programming on TV. Every sport has something special. So something like this, where they had the Tanahashi retirement special itself, that was edited down from the original programming, but it was all other special programming on multiple different broadcast channels.
Yeah.
And so what is New Japan's current TV distribution?
They're on TV Asahi. But the tricky part is that they also own Stardom, but Stardom is on a different broadcast channel. I think their contract is on a different, I want to say it's either on Samurai TV or Nitele, like one of the other competing companies. So I don't know at what point if they're going to actually bring Stardom over, but it also makes me wonder why that Stardom may have not been included in that. I don't know if it was included in that 4 hour special or not the 4 hour special. Sorry. The 1 hour, 40 minute special.
And do you know what kind of time slot they have on TV Asahi? And that's like a broadcast network that people with TVs, if you've got a TV, you have access to it.
Yeah. With the digital, their secondary channel, I think you have to either have a subscription or you have to use your mobile phone to sign up for it. Again, I live outside of the country now. And back when I lived there, we didn't have digital. It was satellite or, you know, expanded cable. So I wouldn't be able to say one way or another. But one of the big things that they were hyping about that TV special was that it was the first time in 22 years that New Japan was being or that wrestling was being broadcast on this channel.
Yeah, it certainly was a story that like cut through in a major way, and it exceeded my expectations. Like, I knew the Tanahashi retirement was going to be big. I certainly didn't forecast it being like this level, that it was going to just really grab interest. And whether it was attached or not, we also saw like Stardom drew a really strong number at Sumo Hall several days earlier. Mm-hmm. Noah did a really good number for its New Year card as well. And of course, like the trickle down effect was New Year Dash was its most attended Dash since 2020. So it seemed that yes, this was a big New Japan peak for several years, but you also saw other companies draw really well this year. Both closing the year and then opening the year in Noah's case.
Well, one of the things about that time of year, like Wrestle Kingdom week or, you know, Wrestle Matsuri, whatever you want to call it, that's Japan's version of WrestleMania week. So especially now that with the pandemic being over and traveling being opening up and the yen being considerably weaker than, you know, the American dollar and probably the several other currencies around the world, a lot of foreign travelers are heading into Japan for these shows. So if you're going to fly in as a wrestling fan, you're probably not going to stick to one particular promotion, unless that's the only promotion you like and you want to go see other stuff. But because there's so much wrestling and it's condensed inside within Tokyo, which is very easy to navigate with public transportation, it makes it very convenient. And usually a lot of them are at Korakuen Hall, Tokyo's Dome, Tokyo Dome City. There's a whole bunch of venues in that area. So it's kind of like you want to maximize your travel dollar as much as possible. You get no sleep, but it is possible to see multiple shows. And this is also the time of year, like your WrestleMania week, where you bring in your big stars, you bring in your special guests, you stack the card with as many people and as many matches, as many interesting things as possible to draw the, especially if you know that there are going to be more people that don't normally come into Tokyo for wrestling. You want to try to, you know, get as many people in your house as possible.
In the case of Saya Kamatani, who was on the card on Sunday, losing the strong women's title to Shuri, what would you say this last month has meant for her overall appeal to the wider audience? Winning the Tokyo Sports MVP, she completed a year as World of Stardom champion, and it does feel like Stardom got a noticeable lift in 2025, and it's been off of her back. In I just want some of your overall thoughts just on the health of Stardom going into this new year and where Saya Kamatani is sort of viewed outside, beyond just kind of the Stardom circle of fans that we're already very familiar, but I think a lot of people maybe becoming more aware of Saya Kamatani over this last 30 days or so.
If I can make a very bold statement, I would say Saya Kamatani is your new Mayu Iwatani, because last year Stardom lost both Tam Nakano and Mayu Iwatani after previously losing Julia and other notable names, that with all the departures to Mari Gold. She's been the one consistently that has been at the center of the company, shouldering the company as the world champion, and also starting to do kind of what Tanahashi and Okada did to a certain extent, which was not just doing Stardom branded co-promotions, but going onto variety TV programming as a guest, which is a very popular thing for them to do with wrestlers in Japan. If, you know, for me, everyone's like, well, did you used to watch Akira Hokuto's matches? And I'm like, I knew her as a TV talent when I lived in Japan, because by then she and her husband had retired. So they were working on any TV show, whether it was a quiz show, a cooking show, a travel show, they were everywhere. So with them trying to do this kind of approach with Saya and probably more wrestlers moving forward, I think, you know, you can't not give her all the flowers, especially after the match she had with Saori Ano less than a week before her match with Shuri.
Before we wrap things up, Karen, I just want to get kind of your overall sense of things, like coming out, like the retirement ceremony with Tanahashi. Like, it not just felt like the end of the Tanahashi era, but really what was kind of the last domino to fall of this, you know, last big resurgence period of like the Okada Tanahashi era. Like, yes, Naito was there. Yes, Shibata was there. But like, that is now in the rear view. How would you say the forecast is now looking for New Japan? That, you know, there's a lot of interesting pieces in place, but, you know, Tanahashi was that last big link to what many people, if they got back into New Japan over this last decade, he was, you know, one of the, you know, he was the consistency throughout that whole period.
Well, as we say, the training wheels are finally off, and they have no choice but to ride at this point. I think, you know, crowning Tsuji as the new champion at Wrestle Kingdom, after, you know, for those who have listened to Bruce and I drone on for the last 2 years since Tsuji's return about how they need to pull the trigger on him, I'm glad they finally did that. I am glad they're getting creative with, you know, finally laying some old factions to rest. But they need to start taking bigger risks when it comes to who they're going to push to the forefront. Because in as much as I love Doki versus Desperado, I've seen it. I really wanted them to make a move with Kosei Fujita, and I think they need to start looking at the guys that they've been talking up the last 2 years and actually start taking risks on them if they want to keep the momentum that they currently have going.
Well, Karen, we can recommend everyone can check. Yourself and Bruce Lord did a very lengthy review of Wrestle Kingdom.
It was 20... very long.
No, that's, people enjoy it. It's up on the free feed on Post Wrestling and the YouTube channel. And you can also catch Karen on a Post Pro Res with WH Park. They will be coming back within the next week. So you will get all of Karen and WH's takes on the post Wrestle Kingdom period for New Japan and heading into 2026.
Thank you so much, guys. I hope you have a great day.
All right. Thanks very much, Karen.
Bye.
So that kind of takes us out of a New Japan discussion. And now we go on over to what is always a favorite part of the show, folks. It's time to go into the one and only legal chapter of Pollock and Thurston. We have a bunch of legal stories to discuss, and where to start. I think we should we can spin the wheel and land on a judge denying WWE a motion in a lawsuit over alleged ring post injury during ring teardown. Brandon, do you want to explain this, and a photo here to support the story as well?
Yes. Have you ever set up a wrestling ring? Have you been around when a wrestling ring's been assembled or disassembled?
I have, yes.
Yes. Have you actually set one up?
I have assisted in putting one up, but I will
say not by yourself. Nobody does it by themselves. It's like an impossible task.
Yes.
Have set up and have helped set up and tear down many rings over the years. It does seem kind of dangerous. I've never seen anybody get seriously hurt. I'm sure it's happened, but so this is a case in Connecticut State Court where after a SmackDown in March of 2024, there's a contractor agency that I apparently had workers there to help with the setup and teardown, and there's a worker named Teodoro Trochet. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his name right. This is the plaintiff in this lawsuit who says that he was injured after there is debris allegedly on the floor in the Mohegan Sun Arena in Connecticut. And he says he tripped on debris and that resulted in the ring post falling on him, causing dental injuries and causing his right hand to be crushed. This is a lawsuit that started in the spring around May or June. The complicated thing here is this is at the Mohegan Sun Arena in Uncasville, Connecticut. So it's on the reservation. It's on the Mohegan Sun. It's under the Mohegan Sun Tribal Gaming Authority. So I think there definitely was some litigation over what venue would be proper. And in any case, W moved to have this case dismissed out of Connecticut State Court. And the judge ruled on Tuesday, yesterday, that no, your motion to dismiss is denied, so this case is going to move forward.
So that is the latest in that story. So that will move forward. What may or may not be moving forward, Dr. Carlin Kolker. He has appealed a court order to produce documents showing that Vince McMahon paid Janelle Grant's medical bills. The slowest moving non-case that we have on a routine basis. Attorneys representing Dr. Carlin Kolker and Peak Wellness are appealing a Connecticut judge's order that compelled them to produce billing statements by January 12th that showed Vince McMahon paid for Grant's medical bills. The basis of Kolker's appeal has not yet been filed with the Connecticut appellate court, but previously, Kolker's side argued that the motion overreaches the permissible scope of a bill of discovery and seeks to convert this limited pre-suit mechanism into an open-ended fishing expedition.
Yes.
So it's a fishing expedition, yes.
Always. We don't know what his brief is going to be to the higher court in Connecticut. It's the same court, by the way. We stayed in the same jurisdiction. The Grant Kolker case, which is a bill of discovery, it's not a conventional lawsuit. It's just a legal action where Janelle Grant is trying to get records, trying to get her medical records, and was trying to depose Dr. Kolker. She was not allowed to depose him, but the judge had ordered Kolker to turn over evidence that would show that Vince McMahon paid for her medical bills. And he is resisting that. He is going to the state of Connecticut Supreme Court appellate, the higher court in Connecticut, to look for an appeal against the judge's order here. So we'll see what happens as that plays out. But all that's there right now is we know that this is an appeal that has happened, but we don't have any actual litigation related to this yet.
And then Dana White is involved in a hearing that was scheduled for Tuesday. This is in relation to the Sorkinov v. Zuffa case that is arguing that the arbitration agreements that fighters have had to sign since around 2021 violates Nevada law in terms of UFC having overwhelming monopsony power. So essentially, Sorkinov is trying to get the class action waivers thrown out. And that's important because fighters that are part of the Cajun Johnson case against Zuffa, they would not be able to recoup anything if these class action waivers hold up, and they would have signed away the ability to be part of any of these class action suits. So that is what the Sorkinov case is. And Dana White was scheduled for a hearing on Tuesday. And what is your understanding of this case and what is what the plaintiffs are at odds with Zuffa over?
So what confuses me here is that this is actually under the Johnson, well, it's under one of the Johnson cases. There are so many cases involved in this this antitrust
lawsuit. There's like three cases going on right now between the Cajun Johnson case, yeah. Misha Sirkunov, and then there's a Phil Davis v. Zuffa case, which are all
right.
They all have different aspects that they are accusing Zuffa slash UFC of.
In any case, you shared a link with me of a story from Yahoo Sports where they're reporting that Dana White has been ordered to testify at this hearing. So I read some of the briefings, and the plaintiffs, they're in a discovery phase, apparently, and the plaintiffs are complaining that the defendants, who are UFC, Zuffa, are not turning over all the evidence that they say that they're supposed to turn over. And mainly the main feature seems to be around evidence that would come from certain UFC employees, including Dana White. What they're saying is that there are long gaps of time, years, where they don't have documents from different devices, where apparently, you know, they say that Dana White started using this certain iPhone and then he used it for years, and we don't have any of those records. And there's disputes too over whether they can, you know, get evidence from these devices, because these employees say that these are their personal devices, but the plaintiffs say no, but they still conducted business on these personal devices. Therefore, they are eligible for discovery. So that's what's happening. And we were looking at potential spoliation. Does everyone remember what spoliation is? Because we're dealing with it in the W shareholder lawsuit also, or potential spoliation. Potentially, they may not be able to recover this evidence. Maybe they've lost it or destroyed the phones, thrown. I don't know. They're saying that they don't have access to these phones. So if they don't have access to this evidence and they can't turn over the evidence, we may be looking at spoliation here, which means the evidence that was supposed to be protected and supposed to be preserved was not preserved, and that could be bad news for the party that is the defendant, Zuffa, that cannot overturn them, which may lead to an adverse inference if it goes to that extent. They're also looking for sanctions against the defendants too, for not cooperating with discovery, not cooperating with court orders. So this hearing did happen. I can't tell you what happened at it, but this hearing that happened yesterday, where Dana White was supposed to testify, the hearing did happen. But as federal lawsuits, as it appears on the docket, you have to wait months to get access, because they're allowed to redact things and review them. So several months always go by before these hearing transcripts end up viewable to the public on the docket.
Any reference to Langus?
So there is a brief mention of Signal, which is Langus spelled backwards. That is not the main feature. The main issue is that that the devices are not being, are not being dealt with at all. They don't have the devices. There was a mention of Langus, though. Well, not Langus, of Signal. It's not just Dana White's devices, or it's not just a Dana White related discovery that they're after here. There's a list of 20 something UFC slash TKO employees who they want evidence related to. And it includes Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro, Jason Lublin, who is the Endeavor CFO. I think he may have had a title under UFC as well. Grant Norris.
He as well, the recipient of a prediction by Mark Shapiro in July of 2022. He was on the email to Andrew Schleimer and Lublin.
Yes. Seth Krause, the chief legal officer. So and a lot more than that. Joe Silva is mentioned in here. They want a lot of evidence that they're not getting yet, it's a recurring theme here, where we have disputing parties and they're litigating over what evidence the other side is entitled to.
Yeah. And John Nash has done a lot of reporting on this for the Sirkunov case in specific. UFC has filed an appeal in the Ninth Circuit to just avoid discovery altogether. Don't know if that one will be granted or not. And then the Davis case, if people are trying to keep track of all of these cases, Phil Davis used to fight in the UFC, left the UFC years ago, and he is representing fighters outside of the UFC, stating that they have been damaged because of some of the monopsony power that UFC has, and is only seeking injunction relief. They're not looking for money in their case. But the interesting part is that Davis was part of the Kung Lee settlement, and therefore, after that case settled, he may not have standing to be able to sue them. So that still has to be determined. So I don't know if there's going to be resolution to any of these cases for a long period of time, but such is the case with a lot of these suits that we cover. But
a 10-year lawsuit at least in the Lee case, right? Has the Lee case been settled? That
the Lee one is done. The Lee one is settled. Fighters have received money. Like, that one's done. And now the Cajun Johnson case, which represents the fighters from July 1st of 2017 up to the present, that one is like, they have to still seek certification. Like, that could be, like, we could be looking at years. As you mentioned, it was 10 years for the Kung Lee case to reach a settlement. So you got to kind of be in it for the long haul.
Don't forget Judge Richard Bulwer, who is the judge, ordering his former high school classmate to a hearing.
That's right. They all went to Bishop Gorman together. What a fun lunch hour that must have been.
With the Fertitas.
That is correct. Yes.
Yes.
All right. We're going to do a catch up on some viewership notes. So going back a week ago to the December 29th edition of Raw, this was a live episode after they had a taped show the week prior. For what I believe was the fourth week in a row, they did not rank. The number 10 show on the global top 10 had 2.8 million views. So that is what Raw fell.
It's the lowest floor yet for these non-ranking weeks.
It is, yes. And it's going to be very interesting to see. Like, this week's show was a really hyped up episode of Raw, but this is also the week that, you know, you had the finale of Stranger Things. You have, like, God knows what else that maybe crossed hit the zenith of a Netflix engagement. But last week's Raw, it was 8th in the US, 9th in Canada. I believe those were the only countries it ranked in as well. I hate to say it, but it looks like Bolivia is falling out of WWE fandom. If that's our bellwether, Bolivia, the peak's over, folks.
That's how you know. It's been what? Let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 out of the last 6 weeks, it has not ranked globally, but the floor has been quite high. Yes. This most recent measurement we have for the 29th, it was 2.8, which is within where they've been in November, right? Mm-hmm. So it tells you it was less than 2.8 or tied it with 2.8. But still ranking in the US except for the week of December 22nd. So does this mean much? I don't know. We should mention, because we have a listener who pointed out a good point about my comment about SmackDown being down. I did not take into account that Big Data Plus panel is of course affecting the TV ratings. So the difference I did calculate is it's down 24% SmackDown is in Q4 versus the Q4 of the prior year. So I mean, it's down about 20% apparently due to Big Data Plus panel. So a lot of that could be excused with Big Data Plus panel.
NXT from last week did 604,000 viewers, 0.07 in the demo. So they were down 13% in the demo. Audience was basically even. Dynamite on New Year's Eve, the all-time low for Dynamite on a Wednesday night. What does this mean? 398,000 viewers and a 0.07 in the demo. I am amazed they did this much on New Year's Eve, to be quite honest. But that is probably your rock bottom number that, you know, a tornado could go through your home and these fans are going to find a way to watch Dynamite.
Yes, the demo held up better than the overall audience.
Yes. So you know what? That is your loyal audience. And then the big one, SmackDown going to 3 hours.
Yes. Buffalo.
In Buffalo, no less. Brandon, I think I'll speak for him. I don't think he went to this show.
I did not go to the show. No.
No. 1,175,000 viewers and a 0.28 in the demo. So, males increased in the demo. Women were down. They have a sense of when enough is enough. But they did get a slight bump from the week prior as well, as the 3 hour era is back in our lives. And then Collision, which in comparison to the Collision that aired on Christmas, this audience, 241,000 and a 0.03 in the demo. Their overall viewership was actually up. That was up 11%, but the demo was down 24% from the Christmas edition of Collision. So I think Collision is almost impossible to gauge anything from. These time slots move all over the place with such regularity. It is going against, it airs on Christmas one week. It's back to Saturday this week. December, it's just been all over the place. So, I mean, you can decipher this, however you would like, but, there you have it. It feels like it is just a wild time when it comes to deciphering any of these figures.
Credit to Spoiler TV for helping us decipher what the ratings were. Did you try to solve the latest programming insider puzzle?
No, I did not.
For people who don't know what we're talking about, Programming Insider, which it has, you know, for the last year or two been the source for TV ratings. Our friend Douglas Pucci has been out for a little while, and these ratings. Oh, maybe they did fix. Well, no, I think they did. Well, maybe they did. I don't know. Anyway, it's become, you know, you get a random random assortment of table configurations.
It feels like raw data that has been emailed. That, I mean, as the man I always credit for taking dense information and putting in wonderful chart color coded form, this has to drive you up the wall.
Yeah, it's difficult to read, to say the least.
Yeah, like the headings don't match. Like you have to.
Yep, you have to figure, because there'll be like a long list of headings that will just be like one after another in a long.
You have
column.
To move them to over. Like, okay, it's like we've got like 10 columns here that they're offline. I mean, let's all get together for a Programming Insider to try and make sense of this. Okay, we're simple people. We just need some help. Yes. All right. We have some more super chats, so let us go through. We will answer what we can here. Oh, look at this. Yes. The real pay-per-view numbers for AEW are on Langus. Yes. We're not in that special chat. John, any update on Chris Jericho you can share? I don't have any update on Chris Jericho. If you want to go based on what was reported, this is by Variety. He was apparently, people thought he was going to be in the Upside Down on Monday on the Stranger Things edition of Raw, but he was not. When Variety reported his contract extension, they had stated he had signed through the end of December 2025. Now, as we know with these contracts, time can be tacked on. There can be all these different aspects. If you go with that, you would presume he is contractually free. Cannot say that definitively. I think everyone expects him in WWE. So I am of that belief as well. But that is the Chris Jericho story. Any 2026 predictions? Peace and harmony online. No more wrestling politics, and we will be joined by a representative from Philippe. Those are my predictions for 2026.
Who will main event WrestleMania? Night two.
Mm-hmm. Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns
again.
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Are you gonna watch night two of WrestleMania? That's the question.
The toss up. You never know.
Depends.
I did not watch much of WrestleMania this past year. I think I put it on for a time. I watched most of the Rumble though.
Yeah, we get the we have the Saudi Rumble coming up in just a couple of weeks. As well.
I've been alerted. There are at least pictures that seem real of a pop up stadium being built for the Royal Rumble.
Okay. So what, they just tear it down after the show's over?
I don't know. Maybe they'll leave it up for the World Cup. I did try to message. So it was going to be at the is it the King of Abdullah Arena? That's where it was advertised originally. But I guess they want to accommodate a larger crowd. And I did try to message the venue and ask them where is it going to be, and they said you can go to WeBook. Basically, and if you go to WeBook, it says the event is going to be at the King Abdullah Financial District, and if you Google that,
that's
shows
what's
you,
listed on WWE's site, KAFD.
Okay, well, if you Google the King Abdullah Financial District, you get like a specific Google Maps will, you know, like highlights a specific area of the city, so maybe that's where that is being built. I know there are many comments online about this pop-up stadium, and I will say the potential for migrant workers to be building that and maybe in not good conditions it's possible. Yeah. I don't know that we'll get any information about that. I still need to look into what the public records law is in the kingdom.
Well, that will be a future topic as we head into the Royal Rumble and the status of the pop-up stadium. Do we know how big of a venue this is going to be roughly?
Presumably bigger than the other venues. So I think that was in the around 30,000, supposedly.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, we are going to bring the show to a close, but I want to thank Karen Peterson for joining us. And you can always follow our work over at postwrestling.com. Brandon has several stories up this week, including the holiday tour complete with graphs. So you can go back, see how they performed in prior years and how this 2025 tour held up, as well as all the latest in the world of Dr. Carlin Kolker and more. So you can always check out that. And then over patreon.com/WrestleNomics, you can keep up to date on all of the television happenings and everything else WrestleNomics related.
Yes. And I still have to do the monthly updates for the mark-to-market comparisons for the most matches for the year. We'll be processing that data soon. Scheduled to do another AEW quarterly business program with one Josh Nason, and with that comes along the WrestleNomics produced key performance indicators for AEW. So look for that, all that soon.
Okay. I look forward to it as always, wrapping up the year for AEW, a very interesting year for All Elite Wrestling. So we will be back next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Thanks to everyone for joining us live. Thank you for the super chats, and we'll speak with you next week.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL, and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.